Adventurous Audio. From idea to ear, we make audio an adventure. The story at the heart of this third series of Inside Forensic Science is an utterly intriguing historic murder mystery involving mishandled evidence, a chaotic crime scene, fraud, characters who vanish into thin air, and a main suspect who one minute you think must be guilty, but then maybe not guilty, but then maybe guilty again. In its day, the case caused a sensation. Over the course of the 10-day trial, the Scotsman newspaper alone devoted an average of 20 columns a day to report proceedings. And it's estimated over 1.5 million words were telegraphed in connection with the trial. But it is a complex puzzle, and it's had all of us, even our experts, tied up in knots.
Super complicated.
I, of course, am used to reading transcripts, I'm used to presenting evidence, I'm used to reading cases. I found it very difficult to follow.
Sensational, but dry in parts.
The first thing I thought was, if I was involved in this case and the world and his wife had trampled through it like they did in this case, I would not be best pleased.
Very, very many elements to it.
Because I have read through these extracts quite often, and I'm confused. I've even tried drawing it out and making notes as I would do in a routine case, and I still go, well, I don't really quite understand what's happened.
The old proverb, actually, how to eat an elephant bit by bit, springs to mind when I first looked at it. It appears overwhelming, but it is doable.
I love that eating an elephant analogy, and that is just what we're going to do. Eat this case, bite by bite, with plenty of pauses while we digest what we've discovered. Now, I'm here with Duncan McKenzie. How should I describe you, Duncan?
Deer stalker, I suppose, is what I do most of.
Well, I'm with Duncan, and we've come to a private estate in the north of Scotland, very much like the one where the case took place. We've got shotguns, ear defenders, eye goggles, because we're hoping to shed light on something which happened over 130 years ago, but remains a real mystery to this day. Duncan, I'm hoping you're going to keep me straight in terms of the health and safety. We've got live ammunition, haven't we?
We'll tick all the boxes, don't worry.
Fantastic. There is a link to the trial papers in the episode notes if you want to follow them as you listen. Well, while Duncan and me get sorted, let's get a bit more background to the case and why we're looking at it. I'm Penny Stewart. This is Inside Forensic Science, the Ard Lamont Mystery. Episode 1, A Death. The location for our story is the grounds of the Ard Lamont Estate near Tinnabruich village on the Cowell Peninsula, on the western arm of the Carles of Bute in the west of Scotland. It's on the Scottish mainland, but it's a remote and rural location. This is picture postcard Scotland. Heather-coloured hills dropping down to a craggy coastline, framing an impressive and elegant Georgian country house with extensive grounds and secluded beach giving breathtaking views over to the Isle of Arran. Our story starts early on the morning of Thursday, August the 10th, 1893. And it was a pig of a morning. Coarse, as one observer described it. Thunder, lightning and rain. James Dunn, a watchmaker from Newcastle, was in the schoolhouse where he was on holiday with his half-sister. Looking out of the pantry window, he sees three men, Hambra and Monson, he recognises as being part of the group who've taken up residence in the Ard Lamont house. The third man is a stranger.
About 9 o'clock, I saw Mr. Hambra, Monson and a stranger on the road near the house. That is the road which passes the west side of the schoolhouse going north. I was at the pantry window, which looks south. I saw Hambra jump over the wall and pick up a rabbit, which he handed to the third person, whom I did not know. They went past the gable, out of my sight, and I then changed my position to the front window of the schoolhouse. I saw them cross the turnpike road and jump over the wire fence into the plantation. The three walked a short way together Then Hambra struck off by himself to the right. Monson and the other man keeping to the left.
Hambra was 20-year-old Lieutenant Windsor Dudley Cecil Hambra, always known as Cecil, scion of the supposedly moneyed and well-connected Hambra family of Pipewell Hall in Northamptonshire and Steep Hill on the Isle of Wight. Monson was 32-year-old Alfred John Monson, a charming, quasi-aristocratic graduate of Oxford University, who'd been employed as Cecil's tutor 3 years earlier, although it's tempting to describe his relationship to Cecil as more influencer than teacher. Earlier in the summer, Monson had taken on the lease of Ardlamont Estate in Cecil's name and moved there with his wife and three children before Cecil joined them a month or two later. The third man, the stranger, James Dunsall, was purported to be a boating engineer acquaintance of Monson's called Edward Scott, who'd arrived just a couple of days earlier. So, Monson, Hambra and Scott are out shooting rabbits on the estate. They have two shotguns between the three of them. Hambra, holding a gun, goes one way. Monson and Scott, the other. Monson has the gun. The top plan there,
yeah,
as I understand it, is from the schoolhouse and in where he last saw them.
Yeah.
Here, Duncan and me are looking at a map which was provided at the subsequent trial, showing where the three men were purported to have walked.
Gallery window. All right. Okay. So they're walking up this way.
Yeah.
Up the road. D&E. What's here? Corner junction of two roads. Where the three separate, so he's looking at them from this side, is he?
Yep.
F, direction of
Monson and Scott.
Monson and Scott, G, direction of Hambra. I was slightly puzzled as to why they would have split up at all. Could you...
Well, rough shooting, that's what you do, but you're usually maybe 20 yards between you, and you would be split up if you were going through like long heather or something like that to flash birds usually. But rabbits is always a dodgy one because they're scuttling around on the ground. You need a fair bit between each other and the line's got to be very straight, so you can't have one gun ahead of the rest of them. In saying that, I think this is amateurish Victorian shooting. I think they're playing at the thing rather than a professional. I think a lot of these Victorians, you know, they had to do it. It was part of the rite of passage. You take an estate and you kill a stag, whether you want to do it or not. You go shooting and it's part of the deal. I suspect that's what's involved here with Hambra. He was saying, you're a lieutenant now, you're a big guy. Go and take an estate for the whole season and go and kill stuff. And they killed everything, you know. Blackbirds, ospreys, didn't matter. They flattened it. I think there's a bit of amateurishness involved with the shooting. But this, the...
Because of the way they've kind of just...
Yeah.
In terms of this map, gone together and then split up and separate?
You haven't got a clue what each one is doing. The thing that you should note from that is... That F is the direction of Manson and Scott and G is Hambra.
Yeah.
Hambra is to their right.
OK, back to James Dunn, looking out the schoolhouse window.
It was about 3 minutes after I lost sight of them that I heard the shot.
Shortly after that, Monson and Scott appear back at Ardlamont House. James Wright, the butler, takes up the story.
Scott was carrying rabbits, and he said that they had fallen to Mr. Hambra's gun. Neither of them had guns in their hands at the time. Monson said Mr. Hambra had shot himself. And when I asked, had he shot himself in the arm, he said no, it was in the head, and he was quite dead. I asked him where the body was, and he said in the wood. I went out to look in the shrubbery. I could not find him, and ran back and told Monson, whom I had left with Scott at the door of the dining room. He said, come, and I will show you. I passed out with him by a door at the back of the house, past the stables at the back of the house. As I was passing the stables, I saw White, the gardener.
Monson said to me, young Hambra has shot himself. See him find something and bring him up to the house. I went and found a rug, which I took with me to the plantation, Monson leading the way. The body was lying upon the grass on the top of the old dike. I looked at the body and I saw that it was dead. It was lying on its back, turned a little to the left side. There was no gun near the body, and Monson was not carrying a gun when I first saw him. I saw a wound on the back of the head, and there was a good pool of blood under the head on the ground. A small hole in the ground was full of blood. That was all the blood that I saw on the ground. The head was nearest to the Rowan seedling, which I knew. We had taken the rug with us. There were other people who were helping. The people present were Stephen, the factor, Stuart, Carmichael, the elder Carmichael, the ploughman, and James Lyon, who had his cart. After placing the rug under Hambra's feet, we drew it below the body. It was lifted and placed in the cart and taken up to the house, round up by the offices and by the end of the wood. When we got the body to the house, we undressed it. I identify these clothes. The only blood I noticed on the clothes when they were taken off was a little about the collar. That, along with the blood at the head, was all the blood I saw. I don't remember if there was any blood on the rug when we took the body out of it. Monson wasn't present when we put the body in the rug. I don't know what became of him. He went away after pointing out where the body was.
Hambra is dead. They've wrapped up his body in a rug and taken him back to the house. And now Carmichael, the coachman, is off to fetch the local doctor. Let's pause there, because straight away things have gone bounding off in a very different direction to how they'd be dealt with if the same thing happened now.
Now, I doubt I'd be called at all.
Dr. Miles Mack is a GP partner in Dingwall Medical Group.
It would be a call to the police and probably the ambulance as well. And the police would view it as a firearms death and would become involved in investigating that under the direction of the Procurator Fiscal.
I have been involved with firearms incidents, suicide, accidental discharge and murder. But in essence, all the scenes would be approached the same way. So every incident in which a firearm's discharged, they always have a crime scene manager. So as soon as the crime scene manager gets there, generally this will be after they've established that the deceased is indeed deceased, because the number one priority for the police is the preservation of life. So once they've confirmed that life is not compatible, then that's when we lock everything down, a cordon gets put in place, a scene log started. The scene log's basically got who's coming in to the scene, why are they coming into the scene, what time, what protective equipment they're wearing, if they've been involved in any other scenes relating to this investigation, or in terms of firearms, have they been near anything that could possibly have firearms residue? And then at the end, when we sign out, that's also on the log as well.
That's Rachel Aitken, a senior forensic scene examiner for the Scottish Police Authority, basically a Scottish CSI. We're going to hear loads from Rachel in the next episode, but for this episode, let's stick with the doctor, because the decisions he makes about Hambra are crucial to how everything then plays out.
I am a Bachelor of Medicine and a Master of Surgery, and I've been in general practice in Tynabruich since 1884.
So this is Dr. McMillan, the local GP. The words are taken from his appearance in court.
I was attending Mr. Monson's family professionally at Ardlamont, and I made the acquaintance of Mr. Hambra. On the 10th of August, about 10 o'clock in the morning, the Ardlamont coachman came to me saying that I was to go to Ardlamont as Mr. Hambra had shot himself. I arrived there about 11:30 and saw Mr. Stephen and Mr. Monson. Mr. Stephen took me to the room where Mr. Hambra lay. I found the body lying on the bed, quite dead. On the right side of the head, I found a wound involving the scalp and the bone. The wound was smooth behind and jagged and irregular in front, a little wider in front than at the back. I inspected the wound and felt with my finger that there was a hole in the skull. I'd already been told by Mr. Stephen what had occurred, and from my examination, I had no doubt that it was a gunshot wound. I fancied the charge would be in the head, because I thought that a charge fired at that near distance would have gone more directly, and that the charge would be in the head.
So I was aware that the role of the GPs has changed quite considerably over the last 100 years, and I have been interested in the history of general practice and how it developed in Scotland. And so actually the idea that the doctor was called to the case was startling, because I wouldn't be called to a firearms incident now. But actually my sympathy for the doctor being put in a position of being asked for a medical certificate of cause of death, and reflecting on how sometimes there is still discretion about how we present that and the responsibilities that we have to complete a death certificate. And quite often we're quite exposed in that situation, although obviously in the present time we've got a lot more backup. Earlier in my career, we might well have been asked just to confirm life extinct, which is different from doing a medical certificate cause of death. And so I was called to some gruesome deaths on railway lines and cars. But now the police and the ambulance services are able to declare life extinct. So no, I wouldn't probably be called at all.
I have never before in practice seen a gunshot wound in the head. There was a lot of blood soaking the dressings and the pillow on which the head was lying. I examined the wound to see if there was any blackening or singeing, but could find traces of neither.
And I suppose even though it's a very rural area that this happens in, there's no reason why he would have particular experience in guns. There's no training that says, oh, you're going off your rural area. Tell you what, we better look at gunshot wounds in case you happen to be dealing
Absolutely.
With someone out.
Absolutely.
Shooting game.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you've been a junior doctor in Northern Ireland in the Troubles, it would be a different matter. But the vast majority of us won't see gunshot wounds. And actually, most general surgeons still won't see gunshot wounds specifically unless they've got military experience or experience of working abroad. Because, thank heavens, they're incredibly rare.
Back in 1893... Dr. McMillan finished his examination of Cecil Hambra, bound up the head, cleaned away the blood, and helped to dress the body. Then, perhaps a bit curiously, he went upstairs to have lunch with Monson and Scott. Duncan, I found that detail slightly weird.
Dreadful, yeah.
Do you think it's just of its time, of its class?
Well, definitely of its time. They were doing crazy things in Victorian times compared to us now. But there's something not quite right about that. It just doesn't lie easy with me either.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
Weird.
Right, let's get back to Dr. McMillan. Now he's had a chance to have a good feed.
After luncheon, I asked Monson to give me a more particular account of what happened. We went into another room and I took some notes in Monson's presence, having in view the fact that the Procurator Fiscal would have to make a report. He said the name of the deceased was Windsor Cecil Dudley Hambra, and that his own name was Alfred John Monson, that he was no relation of the deceased. And then I asked him as to the course of events. He said both had gone shooting rabbits with Mr. Scott. They had gone shooting in the wood to the southeast of Adlamant House, at the south end of it. Mr. Hambra taking the right or east side along the turf bank, Mr. Monson the left, and Scott walking in the middle carrying the rabbits. When near the end of the wood, he heard a shot fired and called out, "Have you shot anything?" But he got no response. And shortly afterwards, Mr. Scott, he said, came up and they turned back together. They'd not gone very far along the turf wall until they found Mr. Hambra's body lying in the ditch. There was no sign of life in the body. The gun was close beside it.
Well, there's no reason for him to really question what he's been told in terms of he tripped and the gun went off. I wouldn't know that it wasn't possible to trip and have a gun go off. If someone said to me and I didn't have the experience of it, well, OK, you know guns. You've told me that that's possible. Why would I question it?
I suspect in that class of society, firearms were the norm, that actually shooting and fishing were very much the expected pastime. So in that respect, I suspect he'd have seen the effects of firearms on other animals, because that was the nature of a great deal of outdoor activities. But yes, I think actually in the situation that you find yourselves with a human body and that sort of accident, I think he would find himself very unprepared and very much alone in the decision he needs to make. I suspect he probably didn't. I don't know. He probably did need to make a decision about that and probably rashly went into it. It certainly sounds like he regretted it later. Patronage from these people at Ardenman House would probably have been quite important to him. At that time, there was no NHS, and doctors' incomes, particularly in rural areas, was very insecure. And in fact, in 1912, the Dewar Report actually realised that this was such an issue that they developed the Highlands and Islands Medical Service, which was a forerunner of the NHS, because they just couldn't get doctors to work in rural areas. So his patronage of that family would be really important to him, because it probably is important that these are one of the few patients who could actually afford to pay him, where there may well be people in the population who couldn't, and he's providing care almost pro bono because patients are not able to pay him, or if they are paying him, would be paying only a small amount or paying in kind, all that sort of things. So that would be the first issue. He probably would be quite keen to please them and to take them as it found. I wonder what level of mistrust would you want to have of these people? There's always this business about having a degree of suspicion and a degree of skepticism about the message you get. But equally, you don't want that to overrun things. You don't want to become paranoid in all your work. So those are the sort of things which occurred to me, even if firearms is something that is way out of my sphere of experience. But actually, I suspect that's what his situation was too. But he was in a different situation about actually having to respond to it.
I guess if someone has been shot, there's a limited number of explanations. Either they shot themselves deliberately or by accident, or they were shot deliberately or by accident. So Dr. McMillan doesn't have an endless number of scenarios to consider. I have to say, Duncan, I do find Miles Mack's point about patronage an interesting one. You live in a small Highland community. Can you understand why the good doctor might have wanted, even subconsciously, to find in favour of Monson, because that paid the bills?
Yeah, I could understand that. I mean, the Toffs, as they were called, they didn't lease Ardlamont, they took it, and they would take it for the whole season. So it was important to Ardlamont to get that cash through. The thing that worries me is that this poor guy was shot in the back of the head, and we'll see once we try to recreate that with the unloaded shotgun how very difficult that's going to be.
OK, well, in fairness to Dr. McMillan at Ardlamont, he did have a fair old head scratch about what might have happened.
After lunch, I went to the place where the body was said to have been found that day. Mr. Stephen and Mr. Monson, who had his little boy with him, went with me then. When we got to the place, Mr. Stephen said that when the body was found, it was lying either there, pointing to a place in the ditch about 6 or 7 feet south from the rowan tree, or there, pointing to another place 6 feet further south, but not quite in the ditch. Monson corroborated him. There was no blood to be seen, and my attention was not called to any place where there was blood. At the time, I was standing on the top of the west wall looking down. It would be about 2 or 3 o'clock. There was no appearance of blood or of the ground having been disturbed, and I said to Mr. Stephen, "It does not appear to have been there or even there, because the grass does not seem to have been disturbed." Mr. Monson said he was not quite sure of the exact spot. At that time, I had not been told that the body had been found on the higher level, on the top of the dike.
OK, so this is all happening between the new plantation and the old plantation.
Yeah.
What is it he said?
It's just funny it's within a lot of cover. You know, there's a lot of cover in there. You look at that first map. This was 10th of August it happened. This bracken would be high, the gorse would be high. There'd be a hell of a cover in there. And no doubt there'd be rabbits in there. But you wouldn't get clear shooting within that.
So you think it's a strange place to be shooting in the first place?
Yeah.
So was he found in the ditch or on top of the dike? Well, the only people who would know for sure are Monson and Scott. And according to Dr. McMillan, Monson said he wasn't quite sure. If I took you to that location and said, right, look around here, what do you think the markers would be that would tell you where he fell, where he might have been?
What you would find is you would find bashed down bracken, but of course you must consider that this is a shooting estate. They'd be in there, they'd be stampling around that ground themselves, they'd be shooting, they'd be maybe there was cows. I think there was cows involved in this at some point. They all make a mark, plus there'd be deer in there foraging in there at night. For my money, the marks on the ground are irrelevant compared to the wound to that guy's head and the location.
Okay, so it's
on the head.
Lots of noise, potential noise from other external factors going on. So a really difficult ground to just go and read.
Yeah.
I think it's not hard to think that Dr. McMillan must have smelt a rat with all this. Nothing sounds to add up. The following is the report he submitted to the Procurator Fiscal. We're going to hear all of it because this case is so confusing it does no harm to be reminded of exactly where we've got to.
On the 10th of August, 1893, I was asked to go to see Mr. Hambrough, who it was said had been shot dead. I arrived at Adlamant House about 11:30 a.m. and found the deceased, whom I identified, lying in a room on the ground floor. The body was still warm, but rigor mortis was commencing in the limbs, showing that the death must have taken place about 3 hours previously. I found the bed much soiled with blood, which was oozing out of a wound in the head. This wound was a large, ragged one, about 3.5 by 1.5 inches on the scalp, extending upwards and forwards from the right side of the occipital protuberance to near the back of the right ear, part of which had been carried away. About the centre of the scalp wound, there was an irregular opening about 1 inch in diameter, right through the occipital bone into the brain. The bone had been carried into the substance of the brain. The wound was exactly what I would expect to find from a charge of small shot fired from a distance of perhaps 12 inches. The shot had not time to spread, as there were no separate pellet marks. I would expect blackening of the edges of the wound from the powder, but afterwards ascertained from Mr. Monson that they had been trying amberite, a nitro powder. That explains the absence of blackening. The skin or hair was not burned. Mr. John Stephen, factor at Lamont, informed me that he and three others removed the body from the scene of the fatality, where he found it. When he saw the deceased first, he was lying in the ditch beside a turf wall. His gun, lying beside but not grasped by the deceased as described by Mr. Monson, was not seen by the witness. Mr. Alfred John Monson, at Lamont House, informed me that he and the deceased had gone rabbit shooting together, the witness taking the west and the deceased the east side of the strip of wood, Mr. Scott walking between and behind them to carry game. When last he saw the deceased in life, he was walking along the top of the turf wall. When nearly through the wood, he heard Hambrough's gun go off and called out, "Have you killed anything?" He got no answer. Mr. Scott came forward at the same time, and together they turned to the place from which the shot sounded. They'd not gone more than a dozen yards along the turf dike until they found the body beside the wall in the ditch, quite dead, and a gun beside it, but not grasped. Mr. Edward Scott, engineer on the alert, informed me he was walking about 20 yards behind the deceased, but in the wood, and separated by the thick growth of a nursery of forest tree plants. He heard the shot when near the end of the wood and called, "Have you killed anything?" but got no answer. On coming up to Mr. Monson, they together turned to see what had become of Mr. Hambra and found him as already described. The keeper, Lamont, who cleaned the guns, says that one trigger was full cock and the other down, but as Mr. Monson had removed the cartridge cases, he could not tell if the cap of the empty one had been struck by the hammer. My object in making this inquiry was to be certain that the amberite had not exploded spontaneously. The information above given makes it probable that the deceased was going along the wall with the gun, a short 20 bore under his arm and his finger on the trigger, when his foot caught on something and he plunged forward, put down his hands to save himself, thus lowering the breech, raising the muzzle and pressing the trigger, with the result described in the first part of this report. Given upon my soul and conscience at Tynabruach, the 16th day of August, 1893, John Macmillan, MB, CM.
So Dr. Macmillan concludes there has been a tragic accident. That report is a good example of why this case is so confusing and complicated. Not 5 minutes ago, Dr. Macmillan was claiming he'd never seen a gunshot wound to the head. Yet, in his report to the fiscal, he says, "The wound was exactly what I would expect to find from a charge of small shot fired from a distance of perhaps 12 inches. Forgive me, Dr. Macmillan, but how would you know? Earlier, you'd admitted you'd seen as many gunshot wounds to the head as I have. None." Perhaps I'm being too harsh on Dr. Macmillan. Miles Mack again.
We're putting our professional reputation on the line with each signature. So every prescription, it's us taking responsibility. It's us taking responsibility for what's down there. Even when others have been involved in the care alongside it. So it's that side of the bit that's it's putting our professional reputation on the line, and that's extremely important for a doctor. It's the basis of our registration with GMC. It's the basis for our ability to practice in a community and have that respect. But actually, if we sign anything, then what does it mean? And then the whole currency of what a doctor is lost. So I think it is important, and potentially, yeah, we might well have to stand up in court to defend our actions, and that's not much fun.
Do you think different pressures come from being a rural GP in that respect to maybe one who is in a more sort of anonymous or a city where there's many more GPs, many more people, you might be less exposed?
I definitely do, because he would be living and working in that community. He will be reliant on all the people in the community around him for his normal social functions. So actually to upset them has major repercussions in the longer term, actually about what life is like. And if you get that wrong, you might well find yourself that actually life's not sustainable, that you find your practice is no longer viable. One of the things about being a GP is that we find ourselves in extraordinary situations all the time, because we are, we're the people on the ground, and everything comes to us. All of us have got extraordinary tales to tell, and each individual's tale will sound extraordinary, but actually becomes completely in the normal for a life's career in general practice, because we're dealing with people in their community, and there's not like folk. This communities are amazing, and I think that the training, particularly the training at that time, would have been very hospital focused, and very very sketchy anyway. Most of the training they got would be based on undergraduate education rather than postgraduate training that we get now. And so I would imagine they would come out into the community to work as GPs completely unprepared for the range and what's expected of them, and with a very specific medical model in mind.
Let's get back to the story. We haven't talked much about Scott, the boating engineer and third member of the shooting party, have we? Well, that's because we don't have a huge amount to go on. Reports on this vary, but as far as I can work out, Monson has bought a boat called the Alert on behalf of Hambra, and Scott was allegedly employed as an engineer to look at the boat. He'd only arrived at Ardlamont a day or two before Hambra's death, and he made a very, some might say indecently, sharp exit after it. And by sharp, I mean Scott had lunch with the dock and Monson and then was away on the afternoon boat back to Glasgow. After that, he vanishes. Suspicious as that may seem, because he disappears, Scott doesn't get a major part to play in this drama. And it is a drama. Because shortly after Hambra's body has been sent for burial at the family plot at Ventnor in the Isle of Wight, Dr. Macmillan has a change of heart.
To the report on the above of 16th August, I now wish to make the following addenda. I implicitly accepted the statement of witnesses Monson and Scott that the injuries to Hambra were due to an accidental shot from his own gun, a short-barrelled 20-bore boy's weapon charged with amberite. The apparently entire absence of motive made the bent of my inquiry not so much how could this injury most likely be produced, as how could the deceased have done it accidentally. It now transpires there were no amberite cartridges for this diameter of gun, and that I too hastily came to the conclusion or theory advanced at the end of my former report. Having handled and tried the gun, now in the possession of the Procurator Fiscal, I am convinced the injuries were not caused in the way I thought possible.
So if it wasn't an accident, how did Hambra end up shot? And who did it? We've gone from tragic accident to a murder investigation, and Ardlamont House has become a crime scene.
There's so much loss of evidence there. You know, we've got one witness who's actually washed the blood from the deceased. You know, they could have picked up anything from the rug that he was wrapped in or the cart, which they used to convey him back to the house. So even though the doctor had a look at the deceased at the house, there's no accounting for what might have happened between leaving the scene and arriving there.
We'll hear more from Rachel Aitken, our crime scene expert, in the next episode, when Duncan and me will probably still be puzzling over this map, trying to work out what happened where. What was the true nature of the relationship between Hambra and the Monsons? Who is Scott, and where has he disappeared to? And why would anyone want Hambra dead? So many questions.
In episode one of the Ardlamont Mystery, the experts were Dr. Miles Mack, Duncan McKenzie, and Rachel Aitken. The actors were Paul Murray, Jake Lee, Alan Richardson, and Mark Stephen. Inside Forensic Science is written and presented by me, Penny Stewart. The story consultants and series researchers are Heather Duran and Clara Morris. The sound mix was by Steve Ball. Inside Forensic Science, the Ardlamont Mystery is an adventurous audio production for the Leverhulme Research Centre for Forensic Science at the University of Dundee, and is funded by the Leverhulme Trust.